This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. Thanks for listening to this week's podcast. For the week of April 15th, here are some top stories. In the news,
months after President Donald Trump declared an emergency on the U.S.-Mexico border, the mayor of Yuma has officially joined in. Republican Douglas Nichols sounded the alarm this week when the area's only shelter was already packed with migrants and Border Patrol planned to drop more off. From KJZZ's Front Terrace Desk, Matthew Casey reports from Yuma, where the mayor says he took action to prevent a large homeless population in the city and to protect its residents.
Water cascades down a fountain at the center of a roundabout in the heart of Yuma's downtown district. It's near the time of afternoon that photographers call the golden hour. Softening sunlight slants onto the east side of Main Street, where people will soon gather for dinner or to take in some local art. To an outsider, there's no obvious sign there is an emergency unfolding here. Diana LaBarge has lived here since age 3. She hadn't heard about the mayor's declaration and is upset about missing the news.
Hello, give us heads up. We want to welcome these people.
The people LaBarge wants to greet are migrants being dropped off in Yuma by the Border Patrol, which says it apprehended more than 1,000 people in the area in a matter of days. City officials say roughly 1,300 migrants have been released in Yuma since federal authorities announced there wasn't enough room to take people elsewhere.
Because they're families, they're little kids. Their country is so bad, they're escaping bad society.
LaBarge's stance is one school of thought in Yuma, says Mayor Douglas Nichols.
And then the other side is those that are frustrated with the immigration issues, the lack of modifications to our federal process as well as our federal laws.
Nichols says you can't see the emergency in Yuma because the nonprofits and faith groups helping migrants have so far been able to keep it at a small shelter in a secret location. That will soon change, he says, when the groups get totally overwhelmed and migrants, needing to get to other parts of the country, are left stranded in the streets.
We need to protect our community, as well as we need to make sure that the men and women and the children that are being released are taken care of, and we can't do that. We don't have that capability to actually do that.
The city is not putting up any cash to help the migrants, Nichols says, but he wants the drop-offs in Yuma to stop. People should instead get released in larger cities further inside the country, where it's easier for them to access transportation to other states. If that doesn't happen, or if the federal government won't step in,
there'll just be potentially like civil unrest where people are upset at the level of homeless people.
The Stars and Stripes, Homeland Security, and Border Patrol flags blow in the wind a few miles south of City Hall near the entrance to Yuma Sector Headquarters.
We've been stretching our resources for a long time now, and it's gotten to a breaking point.
Agent Jose Garibay says the Yuma Sector stations have been routinely full of detained migrants, many of whom cannot legally be held for much time. But this week, agents were especially busy. They took in more than 1,000 people in 3 days.
So that just kind of highlights the crisis that we're experiencing here.
Border Patrol releases migrants in Yuma if U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement doesn't have enough space to bring them to places like Phoenix.
So being that they're full, we're full, we're forced to release them into the community.
At the south end of Yuma's historic district sits Bandana Books. Luella and Steve Kaznak keep the fans running to stay cool while they work amongst seemingly countless rows of packed shelves. The Kaznaks support the mayor's decision to declare an emergency. Luella says it's terrible the situation got this far.
Build that wall and shut that border down.
First shut the border down and let these people, let them know we're serious and there is nothing here for them to get for nothing.
Steve and Luella want Yuma to help its existing homeless population, have immigration laws enforced, and Congress to get rid of loopholes in the asylum process.
They're here to take advantage of the system. I have no problem with that. I take advantage of the system, but I'm a damn United States citizen.
Arizona Governor Doug Ducey has said the state will do everything in its power to help Yuma. The head of Arizona's Emergency Management Division says assistance can happen without the governor stepping in, but city officials have yet to make a specific request. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, reporting from Yuma.
Now from KJZZ's original production, The Show, here are co-hosts Steve Goldstein and Lauren Gilger.
Governor Doug Ducey has signed into law a third bill sponsored by Republican State Senator Michelle Ugenti-Reed aimed at making changes to how elections are carried out in our state. The latest bill will restrict the use of emergency voting centers. It comes in response to Maricopa County Recorder Adrian Fontes' creation of five emergency voting centers in the last election, which some Republicans say didn't do enough to vet voters' emergencies. The idea was to allow voters who can't show up at their polling place to cast a ballot ahead of Election Day. Now the legislature is giving the power to decide the location of emergency voting centers to the County Board of Supervisors, and they're requiring voters to declare their emergency and explain why they otherwise would not be able to vote. Here to tell us more about why she pushed for this bill is Senator Michelle Ugenti-Reed. Senator, good morning.
Good morning.
So to start by telling us a little bit about the motivation here, how much of this was about County Recorder Adrian Fontes's emergency voting centers he created last November?
Well, look, a lot of the scrutiny on emergency voting centers came after Mr. Fontes abused the process and arbitrarily set them up in locations that people were not told about. So it led to the frustration from the public and ultimately led to a bill being passed to move that authority to the Board of Supervisors.
Was the problem with the location? Was the problem with the fact that voters didn't have to, as you're requiring now, declare an emergency?
The problem was it was just random and arbitrary. He didn't involve the public in the decision-making process. A lot of people didn't even realize you could utilize or we had the ability to operate emergency voting centers. And it's because of that people thought that he misused his authority, and now we've placed it in a much better spot with the Board of Supervisors, and they'll ultimately be able to decide whether they want to be used, where the location, the time and manner.
Senator, you know I have to ask this question. I apologize in advance, but you are a Republican. Recorder Fontes is a Democrat. The majority of the county supervisors are Republicans. Has this become a more of a political fight than an actual practical fight?
No, absolutely not. This is practical because this goes the power now to administer these is going to be transferred from the recorder to the Board of Supervisors. There's 15 counties, and some counties have Democrat Board of Supervisors. So this isn't partisan politics. This is in a response to someone who abused his authority, and the public was frustrated and disappointed, and the legislature had to take action.
So why shouldn't the state and its counties allow early voting right up until Election Day? This sort of creates a couple days of a blackout period, right, where you can't go and early vote.
No, it doesn't create a blackout period at all. Early voting ends the Friday before the Tuesday election. So there is that window. Inside that window, that Friday before that Tuesday election, you can elect, a county board supervisor now can elect to use emergency voting centers. So those who have emergencies will be able to utilize them. If you don't have an emergency, you would simply vote day of at the polling location. So this does not restrict anybody's ability to vote. We have multiple ways to vote in Arizona. What this does is this reasserts that you're supposed to be using emergency centers like they were intended to facilitate individual voters' emergencies.
So you do not agree with critics who might say that this is another way to make it harder for voters to vote?
It's not that I want to be disagreeable with that sentiment. It's just factually, it's incorrect. It's intellectually wrong. This does not interfere with anybody's ability to vote. Emergency centers or is supposed to facilitate one's emergency. And that's what this bill addresses and makes sure that it's being utilized for its intended purpose. We didn't touch early voting. All of the early voting options remain the same. And of course, your day of poll voting options remain the same. So it's just not accurate to say this restricts anyone's ability to vote.
All right. That is State Senator Michelle Ugenti-Reed. Thank you so much for joining us.
You got it. Thank you.
And now we turn to Maricopa County Recorder Adrian Fontes, who joins us on the line. Mr. Fontes, good morning.
Good morning. How are you all doing today?
Doing well. So I have to ask you about a phrase that Senator Eugenti Rita used twice in just our just completed interview there, that you abused your authority. How would you respond to that?
Well, I read the law, and my lawyers were sitting there with me when we did it, and so I frankly disagree. We have had the authority as county recorders in Arizona to support and provide for emergency voting as needed for voters across the state for decades and decades. And, you know, this bill, people forget, was completely unsupported and opposed, frankly, by the County Recorders Association and by the boards of supervisors across Arizona. So the stakeholders, the folks who are actually going to be impacted, the decision makers at the local level who actually run elections, felt that this was unnecessary. We all felt that this was something that should not happen. And frankly, I think the governor even got a whole bunch of please veto this letters within the last several days. So, yeah, it's I think there's something more to this than some folks would say.
I'm going to parse words on this one. What if they were not called emergency voting centers? Did that give the other side a chance to say, well, okay, if someone just didn't decide to drop off their ballot, that's not really an emergency? Is the wording, did the wording cause any issues here?
Well, look, let's go to what's actually going on here. The only reason we have this statute in place in the first instance is because these laws are designed around a technological time that doesn't exist anymore. And that is, of course, we have robust early voting in Arizona. Our voters love it, and we're going to keep it. And in the old days, when we had paper rosters to compare back and forth, county recorders needed time to adjust precinct by precinct those lists that would have gone out to the precincts. All of that happened on paper. Well, we use computers now. And so, you know, the question about whether or not we should extend early voting that the governor mentioned in his letter, his signing letter, it's a discussion that needs to be had. We're in a different technological period. So the idea that whether or not this is grounds for this or grounds for that, or whether or not we call it this or call it that, let's take a much more honest approach here. Let's take a step back. What can we do for voters? And, you know, last year, let's not forget, the Arizona State Senate 29-0 passed a bill that would have allowed early voting to extend past February or past Friday through the weekend, as long as the county recorders update their rolls appropriately for election day. Mm-hmm. That's what this part is about. So, you know, I want to make sure that voters get a chance to vote when they want to vote. And if it happens to be that they can't come in on election day Tuesday because of an emergency, the law allows for that. And recorders around the state have been providing this for decades, so I don't know why suddenly it's a big deal.
Recorder Fontes, were there some issues, you think, with the way that you rolled out these five early emergency voting centers last time around? Do you think there's something there and that maybe it should have been done a different way?
No. I do think that the only issue is that the Maricopa County Republicans wanted to play games with the whole way that we administered elections. And they were trying to find some hole, and they decided that they wanted to attack me. And it has been very plain. People know that this only came up because, unlike my predecessor, I announced to the world that if you couldn't make it on Tuesday, you could come in and vote over the weekend. You could come in because you had something that would not allow you to vote on Tuesday, a law that was well established, has been utilized in Arizona for years and years and years. And, you know, in other counties, I've talked to recorders, Republican recorders, that their offices used to post on the door, if you have an emergency, call this number. And they decided they should be open on the weekend, so they changed their policy to be open on the weekend before Election Day. This is not new. It's not unusual. It's just an opportunity for folks to play politics in ways that all the recorders and all the boards in Arizona disagree with. So, you know, and plus, here's the other thing. Maricopa County's had an increase of about 500,000 voters over the last several decades. We've got a lot of people with a lot of circumstances, and those circumstances are up to them to decide. This is about access for voters who might have something unusual pop up, and I wanted to give them access, but I guess some folks disagree with that.
All right. That's Maricopa County Recorder Adrian Fontes. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. In business news.
More and more women are growing old poor. That's according to a report by the national advocacy group Justice in Aging. In Phoenix, the reasons why mirror what's happening nationally. KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie has more on this complex issue.
So we're walking into the women's shelter where we have 120 beds that are always full.
Lisa Glow is the CEO of CAS, the Central Arizona Shelter Services.
And it's an emergency shelter, so it's meant to be temporary as we help them get a permanent home and address all of the issues that may have brought them into homelessness.
Glow says nearly a third of those served at CAS last year were people 55 and older, including many in their 70s and 80s.
By the way, 73% of the women, the elderly women 55 and older staying in our shelter, are first-time homeless.
Like Erin, a 59-year-old woman I'm about to meet. Erin, who asked that I not use her last name, had never experienced homelessness before. But after a series of personal losses, Erin slipped into a depression and couldn't function, she says. Then she lost her job as a business analyst.
And I used the money in retirement to survive, thinking I could get another job, and it just hasn't worked out.
Erin's story isn't unique.
I always assumed that it was drug addicts or just, you know, people that just were the lower part of our society, but it's not. There's a lot of just everyday hardworking people in here, and it really surprised me.
Which means your coworker, your neighbor, even you or me, could end up at a place like CAS.
Yeah, so we're seeing a very disturbing trend of individuals that lived middle-class lifestyles when they were working age becoming poor for the first time when they're older. And that's a shift.
Kevin Prindeville is the executive director of the national organization Justice in Aging. His organization released a study called Older Women in Poverty, and he attributes that shift to a culmination of factors that tend to affect women more than men.
It starts with a difference in education and employment opportunities. Women are often tracked into careers and professions that pay a lower wage than professions that men are more likely to be in.
There's also the wage gap, he says. In 2018, women earned 85% of what men earned, according to the Pew Research Center, which analyzed median hourly pay of full and part-time workers. Domestic violence is also a factor. So is a change in relationship status, like a divorce or death, which can have significant financial implications, especially if her partner was the breadwinner. And then there's the motherhood penalty, a term used to describe the challenges some working mothers encounter compared to their childless colleagues. In this case, Prindeville is talking about the pay gap.
So lifetime earnings of a mother with a child are 28% less than the earnings of a woman that doesn't have a child. And then that's compounded, of course, if a woman has additional children.
And those mothers often need childcare.
And most of the child-rearing costs are on the women.
That's Sterling Newsom. She's the CEO of UMOM, the state's largest provider of homeless services. She says about 70% of the women at UMOM are single moms.
And their average income when they come into the emergency shelter is $6,000 or less in a year.
So if a woman is living on the brink in her 20s, 30s, or 40s, can she recover? Or is she destined to be one of the more than 4 million women, 65 and older, who are living at or below the poverty line?
I think that you could recover if there's other opportunities available. If you have health care costs covered, if you have affordable housing covered, and if you are receiving a livable wage.
And that's the thing, she says. Minimum wage is still low. And if you're a single mom with children, it can be very hard to get ahead.
Oh, this is the intake area that we're
back at CAS.
Through.
Lisa Glow says something that hits a nerve. She tells me that some of the people who come into CAS have dementia.
Oh, gosh. We're not equipped to deal with all of that. We're not funded for all of that. So just think about someone who's sleeping on the streets who has dementia, and that's the reality of what we're facing.
Since this interview, Glow has hired case managers to work with their growing senior population. The Justice in Aging report did include several recommendations that would strengthen existing supports and programs, like expanding 401k participation to part-time employees, enacting paid leave policies, and improving access to programs like SNAP. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
From the Education Desk, here's KJZZ's Mark Brody.
This next conversation may include concepts that are difficult to grasp and for some listeners may be rough. Not literally, though, just metaphorically. New research is looking into how our brains understand and interpret metaphors. Vicky Lai has been working on this. She's an assistant professor in the Cognitive Science Program in the University of Arizona Psychology Department. And Vicky, when you were doing this research, what exactly were you trying to figure out?
Well, the initial question is whether we comprehend metaphoric language differently compared to literal language. Traditionally, metaphor is viewed as a figure of speech in literature research. But these days, and when I say these days, it's pretty much in the past 20 years or 30 years or so, we view metaphor as something that we use in everyday language. For instance, you can say, I had a rough day. And rough is kind of a physical sensation, a tactile sensation, and we use that to talk about how the day goes. And likewise, we use kind of an action kind of verbs like grasping to describe, you know, the students can grasp the idea. And that to us is a form of metaphor. So we're looking at these types of metaphor and see if we use sensory motor systems, that is sensory motor cortices, to understand language.
Is this a way of trying to figure out if people really understand what is metaphorical and what is maybe literal?
Yeah. Well, so we are touching upon the theory of how is language understood. So people would say classic language areas in the brain would be responsible for language processing. And here we're saying that we're actually using kind of a distributed representations in the brain to understand language. We're using the sensory system, we're using the motor system, and we're using, for instance, the emotion system as well to understand language.
So what did you find? I mean, how do our brains interpret metaphors?
So in our study, we looked at exactly grasp an idea, this type of metaphor. And we found that it's not just the classic language areas, it's also the motor system that gets involved in understanding this type of metaphor. And in addition, we find the timing of it. So previous studies use imaging techniques such as fMRI, which have great spatial resolution, but it lacks temporal precision. So people could argue that, well, it could be that it's the language area that's activated, which then spreads this activation to sensory motor systems. But using ERPs, we can answer this question by showing that, well, the sensory and motor cortices are activated quite early, rapidly, at 0.2 seconds. And therefore, that argues for the necessity of these regions in kind of an abstract language understanding.
What does that tell you?
Well, that tells us a lot of things. That tells us that language is kind of embodied. It is not just something too abstract, as the paper title suggests, that it's actually metaphor. What we think something that's very abstract is actually concrete. We're relying on concrete resources to understand the abstract part of meaning.
But are we actually understanding what people are saying? Like, for example, if you say, did so-and-so grasp an idea, or somebody's grasping at straws, are our brains actually thinking of our hands trying to grab onto something, or are our brains really thinking about and understanding what the person is saying to us?
That's actually exactly what we're going for, is that we think that we actually, the brain is thinking you're grasping something physically. If not physically, it's visually imagining that motion being carried out.
Does that help us to understand what the person is actually saying, or is that an impediment?
It is actually a facilitation, according to these findings.
What do you plan to do with these findings? Like, how will they help people understand, you know, sort of how brains work or how language works?
So this sets of studies are more of basics research. So our current work is to kind of try to find a way to use metaphor to help with learning and to use metaphor to help with a person's emotion. So with regards to the learning aspect, so we've developed metaphors for science concepts. Science concepts are abstract. And in this case, we're thinking that metaphors might help. So we're measuring brainwaves of undergraduates learning these abstract concepts metaphorically and literally, and see if there's something there that can tell us whether they have improved learning after metaphorically reasoning of these words.
So if you're using a metaphor to try to help somebody understand, for example, an abstract scientific concept, if you're using a metaphor, which in many ways is sort of, as we've talked about, sort of a verb, an action word that our mind can interpret as something it understands, is it easy to take that and then use it to understand a more abstract scientific or any other kind of concept?
Our preliminary data show that this is the case. And we found that undergrads, they did improve after a metaphorically trend with this learning of the science concepts. And in our EEG data, we also showed that metaphorically taught science concepts show a enriched semantic representation. So in that sense, I think it does help, but we need to do more work to see if that's the case.
Vicky Lai is an assistant professor in the Cognitive Science Program in the University of Arizona Psychology Department.
And this is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. From the Fronteras Desk.
Like in Metro Phoenix, electric shared scooters arrived in Mexico City with disruptive technologies and concerns. While some see innovation and an opportunity to fight urban problems such as air pollution or traffic, others think these vehicles need to be regulated or even eradicated. From KJZZ's Mexico City Bureau, Rodrigo Cervantes reports.
Well, this is kind of embarrassing.
I'm in Parque Mexico in Mexico City. This is a very popular and old park.
I'm going to try one of the many electric shared scooters in this area.
Let's see how it goes. This is the first time I'm riding one of these things.
Starting it was simple by scanning the QR code with a cell phone using an app.
Okay, so that was easy and that was very fast.
But the tricky part was to actually ride the scooter.
I can see it's all about finding the combination of balance and of speed.
So I tried.
Let's try again.
And tried.
I'm terrible.
And tried. And failed.
Seems like this is not for me.
But it's not only me making an effort. Companies that handle these vehicles are struggling all over the world, as some local governments fear of risks to users, pedestrians, and drivers.
We always like to work hand in hand with the government because we know it's the only way to provide this service.
That's Beriana Mendoza, head of communications of Grin, a shared electric scooter company from Mexico City. Grin started to operate last year, and now it's in 18 cities in Latin America.
We do want to expand, but there's some safety issues and there's some infrastructure issues.
Mexico City's new government decided to revise the scooter contracts and regulations recently. Right now, companies work under a pilot program expecting restrictions to their operation zones and number of vehicles. But Mendoza trusts in the way scooters help the city with cheap transportation and less car usage.
Scooter means less cars in their neighborhoods.
Mendoza says her company protects its users with an insurance. And as for air pollution, Grin says its devices have helped reduce 250 tons of carbon dioxide emissions. But other companies face different battles, like Lime, a San Francisco-based corporation with presence in more than 100 cities across the world. I spoke on the phone with Jason Wild, its head of business global operations.
Regulation and infrastructure, those two are big barriers.
Barriers like those are found in Metro Phoenix. Arizona State University banned scooters off campus in October. And as new regulations in Tempe included fees that Lime considered costly, the company decided to leave.
When Lime is not in the market, it's not just Lime that hurts. It's actually the individuals and the residents.
But Wild believes that the current experiences will eventually help redesign cities. He envisions special lanes to shared vehicles everywhere, just like those in Mexico City. And what about adding a lane at ports of entry for cross-border trips?
I think that one's above my pay grade. I would only hope.
Back in Mexico City, I find Nico Bohr, a German who moved here a couple months ago and who rides scooters all the time. For him, the disputes will end when companies, governments, and citizens adjust to each other.
I think there's always going to be controversy when there's a change.
And while the debate goes on, just like those scooter companies, I'll continue my endeavor.
As I try to ride an electric scooter, I'm Rodrigo Cervantes, KJZZ News, Mexico City.
And finally, from the Science Desk, here are co-hosts Lauren Gilger and Mark Brody.
As we just heard, President Donald Trump yesterday signed the drought contingency plan into law. It'll help preserve the Colorado River for the future by limiting the amount of water western states can take. President Trump tweeted out, "It's a big deal for Arizona." Governor Ducey praised the president and fellow lawmakers who helped put the plan into action. The signing of the bill comes just after Congress fast-tracked the measure through the House and Senate. And here to tell us more about this is KUNC's Luke Runyon. Luke, good morning.
Good morning.
So there is some thought that the president signing this means that this process is finally done, but it appears as though that is not actually the case, right?
Not entirely, not just yet. So the president's signature means that the legislative portion of the drought plan is done and that the whole deal has jumped through most of the most difficult hoops that it needed to clear in order to be finished. But leaders from the seven states that rely on the Colorado River still all need to get together to sign the final deal. And they're working on when and where they're going to be able to get together to do that. And really, that's more of a formality at this point. The hard work of getting states on board with the plan is done. And the president's signature is kind of a symbol of that.
Well, what does that final plan do and take on that this current DCP doesn't?
It's basically you have to get all of these water managers into the same room and sign that final deal. It's the same deal that President Trump signed. It's just you have to actually get all of those water managers into the same room and ink the final deal.
Is there a time by which that has to happen?
There isn't. It's basically once you can get everybody in the room, and the people that I talked to yesterday who are some of the people who negotiated this deal said that they're trying to do that within the next week. So they're kind of really ready to wrap it up.
And of course, you know, the DCP sets, as we said, into place, you know, limiting the amount of water states can take if a shortage is declared. Are water managers across the seven western states also like trying to mitigate that or prevent that or forestall that from happening to some degree?
Yeah, I mean, that's essentially what the drought contingency plan was all about, is trying to figure out how to keep these reservoirs from dropping to critically low levels where you either wouldn't be able to generate power or in a really catastrophic event, you wouldn't be able to push water through a Glen Canyon Dam or a Hoover Dam. And so they're looking at all sorts of different tools in that toolbox in order to keep those reservoirs from dropping. One is taking less water out of the rivers, and obviously conservation is a big element of the drought contingency plan.
Luke, do you get the sense from water managers that they feel like they need to maybe even ramp up their messaging to water users that to try to, I'm just thinking that maybe, you know, people hear, oh, the drought contingency plan is done, it's signed, we're good, we can just go back to doing what we were doing and maybe not think quite so much about how we're using water and the amount of water we're using. I'm wondering if water managers are really thinking about their messaging to try to remind people that, no, we're still in a drought, we still need to be thoughtful about how we're using water.
Yeah, I mean, everyone in water, I think, loves a crisis in some way, where that's how you can get the average person to really care about their water use in droughts, in dry times. You see that people end up using less water if you ask them to. If you're a water manager, if you're a water agency in a large city, if you start doing some programs in order to push for conservation, on the whole, people will do that. They'll use less water. But, you know, this year is sort of a test of that because there's high snowpack in the Rocky Mountains. And, you know, the level of crisis, the level of alarm is not what it's been in the past several years. And so there, I think some people are concerned that the focus will shift away from conservation just a little bit now that this plan is in place and now that it's gotten a little bit wetter.
All right. That's Luke Runyon of KUNC in Colorado. Luke, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks.
And you're listening to KJZZ's Stories You Don't Want to Miss, made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation, Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.